Welcome to Momentum Magnet, a podcast to inspire your growth. I'm Karen Morales, and your host in helping you find ways to make positive changes for your business, health, relationships, and life. We always have a path to a happier ending, so let's get started today. Hi, happy Friday, and welcome to Momentum Magnet. We're here every Friday to talk about how you can add more momentum to your life and business. In today's episode, we're diving deep into the sometimes secretive world of venture capital. Today, we are going to be talking to a principal at Founder Collective, one of the first seed stage VC firms in the country. After talking with Parul Singh today, I'm sure you're going to be able to answer some of these pressing questions. What does the future of venture capital look like in 2020 and beyond? What are some of the top tips that VCs want from every founder looking for money? What are some of the biggest mistakes that you should be avoiding in your pitch presentations? And what is that one thing that you can do as a founder to stand out above the rest? Parul Singh is a principal at Founder, and she has spearheaded investments in companies you've heard of, like Embark Veterinary, AdHoc, Smalls, and Electra Labs. She's a former developer and turned product manager for many venture-backed startups and media companies like the New York Times. She was also a founder herself before joining Founder Collective. She founded a learning analytics company out of the MIT Media Lab. I am so excited to have Parul here today to really break down what is sometimes a very confusing world for people interested in starting their own businesses. So without further ado, hello, Parul. How are you today?
Hi, Karen. I'm great. Excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, perfect. Well, I think this is a great timing because we're getting into, you know, the final 40-day stretch of 2020. And a lot of my clients who are operating in, you know, the startup space are really thinking about trends for what happens after one of the most arguably strangest years of our collective lives, right? This 2020 debacle.
Yes. It's definitely been a hot mess of a year.
It's the hot mess of the year. So maybe we start there. And we know personally it was a hot mess year. I mean, for all of us, you know, in our homes and working and educating small people while dealing with some really big needs from a lot of our clients. Maybe we can start and frame your view, having worked on so many different businesses over the course of the last 7 months. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the impact you've seen on your startup portfolio during 2020.
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners are business owners and operators. And you know, to be honest, like, I think that the pandemic has hit different businesses very differently. So we have companies in our portfolio that I think have seen demand increase because maybe they're helping solve some of the problems that that, you know, have arisen from the pandemic. Form Labs is this company in our portfolio that does 3D printing. And really early on, they kind of dove in and they were helping build masks and respirator parts that you could 3D print, like for anyone who had one of these in their home or in their office. Or we have a couple of companies in our portfolio that that are doing, you know, that are working on health related things. So Kinsa, it's a thermometer company. So they're an early warning signal for like schools are using them to measure kids' temperatures before they come inside. Or Whoop, which is sort of like it's like a Fitbit type of product, but for really high end, like for really serious professional athletes. They found that they were actually able to track, like they were able to be an early warning signal for COVID. So certainly we've seen some companies that have really, done incredibly well, or like have seen their demand increase. And then we've seen other companies that have definitely seen the pandemic has kind of made things a lot tougher for them and maybe reduced demand for whatever they're building. I think it's a challenging time for a lot of people right now. So I don't think there's any one thing that we're seeing. We actually just saw this, we saw it split. Like either they were doing a lot better or a lot worse. And everyone's kind of had to wrestle. I mean, a lot of teams too are struggling with where they are now, right? So we have a couple of teams in our portfolio that we work with, and we have over 250 companies that we've invested in over time. So we see a broad range of what's going on. But, you know, there are a few companies that were remote first or have always been remote. But for a lot of companies, there also was a really early on kind of like a reorientation, like, how do we keep working now that we are not going into an office anymore? And I mean, that affects us as a fund as well. So, yeah, so it's been a crazy year for sure.
It is a crazy year. And I'm imagining you have a lot of the same conversations with your portfolio brands that I have with my clients. And it's really starting with what has changed in the needs of the consumer base that you're addressing. And that was always the question that I was talking to clients about getting back to at the beginning of the pandemic and really seeing how your business could pivot or address those needs in different or more deep ways, given there's been a lot of changes this year. So I agree with you. I think that in a lot of cases, people have really benefited from some of these changes in the way we work and live, and other companies really had to dig deep and find a way to pivot and create a resurgence of relevance in these hard times.
That's true. And I think investors are seeing a lot of broad trends. So, you know, in many ways, I mean, the shift to remote work has really been one of the biggest movements. And I think we'll see that impact last. I mean, I think that there's been a sort of love-hate reaction in a lot of even just friends and people I know, or even ourselves, where, you know, there are things that people love about working remotely. And then there are also things that people hate. Like it's, you know, and sometimes it's nice not to have a commute, but then I have other, like one of my coworkers notes that, you know, he no longer has time to, he doesn't get to do his daily podcast listen anymore because he doesn't have his commute. That used to be when he did his sort of like optional media consumption. So working remotely has like a whole new set of challenges. And so we've seen everything from companies that are helping, companies outfit their employees with desks and equipment so that they can work at home, to companies which are helping, do team building via Zoom or via software, where now that's something that you have to do. Like, what's a virtual water cooler like, so that you still get all those moments with your team that you used to get in person? There's been I think that everyone, especially people with kids, are really aware of, there's been an increased focus on ed tech and technology for education. And this is a space where I built a company and my husband works in public education. So, it's very top of mind for sure. But, we have a couple of portfolio companies which are doing remote education, like Skillshare or Code Academy, or we just invested actually in a company called ULesson, which is actually in Nigeria, which is doing like math and science education, all by computer. And so there's more demand for these platforms than there has been in, you know, a decade, because everyone's learning and there's a lot more. I think people have a lot more, there's a lot more scrutiny and we're asking a lot more of these platforms. And then I think the third thing I would say is just that there are a lot of trends that were probably happening before, but that we're just seeing accelerate. And so that's also been a really interesting thing to see.
Yeah, that's interesting. So people that are building businesses around remote workforces and online education are, you know, giving themselves a high five at this moment in time. And I think other people that are listening may be asking themselves the question, because it's hard for those people maybe who haven't started businesses in the past and are going through their first experience with the venture world to really understand what the impact of this economic crisis caused by the pandemic really does to the available investable assets with the venture funds globally. So maybe you could talk a little bit about whether or not you feel like what the world has experienced is at all changing the available investment amounts from VC firms globally.
That's a great question, Karen. And I think I would have to say that the answer is probably less than you would imagine, because, you know, a lot of funds are, they raise their money before the pandemic. So they're sitting on, you know, the amount that they have to invest. I mean, to be honest, I think that the conventional wisdom, at least in the venture world, has been that there is a lot of money available. I think it's just finding, it's getting to it, and it's getting conviction around, like, what, you know, what people want to invest in. Because, you know, despite these trends, I think the question that we're asking ourselves is not just, like, what's the need for right now, but what's going to be the change that's still around in 3 years or 5 years or 7 years? Because no one wants to just invest in something that, you know, is just happening, but that will go away as hopefully we get back to normal. So I don't think the amount of, but to answer your question really directly, like, I don't think the amount of money that's out there has changed. A lot of it was allocated for, like, the way that just venture, raising money for venture works. Like, the money has been allocated. It's there. It's available. Like, we've been actively investing the whole time of the pandemic. I think it maybe changes how we invest a little bit. Like, we used to, you know, really have it as a law that when we were going to lead an investment, we would always try to get face to face with the founders. We try to get that FaceTime with them so that we could really, like, see that we clicked and they clicked. And it's a long-term relationship that you're signing up to as an entrepreneur when you're committing to work with an investor, and vice versa. So that, you know, now we probably end up spending a lot. We spend a lot of that time on Zoom.
As we all do.
There's more. Like, yeah, as we all do. So, I mean, it's a lot. Like, we would probably now try to spend a little extra time so that we can kind of make up for the time that we would have spent before in person. And I have friends at funds who say that, you know, before they lead in, and, like, they might go and have a socially distanced walk with someone, but it changes. I mean, people used to be like, many investors I know were flying around all the time for conferences or to go and meet with a team, or, you know, the cities that you cut. Like, I used to travel every other week to New York to kind of meet founders there. None of that is happening anymore. So it definitely, it makes the relationship building process, which is, like, so important to what we do and being good at it, makes it really different.
I have a question about that, though. I've wrestled with this issue myself to really try to determine if it is a preconceived notion that you can't build the closeness via a digital connection. I mean, I am seeing in some instances, I'm working with a startup right now that has a celebrity founder attached to it. And I did a call with him this week on Zoom from his bedroom with his children. And it was a level of closeness and no walls up that you wouldn't usually have in a lunch at a 4-star restaurant with, you know, a waiter and a white tablecloth. We had that moment, like, life is hard, like, bonding. Yeah. Like, it is hard, dude. I feel you. And you make me feel more normal because you're dealing with it too.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can, I mean, I think there is something about the casual clothes and you're seeing someone's home and there are interruptions and background noise that in some way is more real than the forced formality of a restaurant table.
Yeah, you're totally right. And if there's any silver lining, I think that's what it is. I mean, I agree. Like, I don't think it's impossible to build that connection. I just think it's different, right? Like, you know, what an interesting thing is that, so we have offices in Boston and New York, and since March, when everyone shut down, our investments have been, and normally, like, we really have a lot of our investments are in Boston, New York, and San Francisco. Since COVID has started, we invested in a company in Austin, a company in London, a company in Nigeria. So we certainly are connecting with these founders in different, you know, remote, like we, and another company, one of the New York based companies that we invested in, the whole team was actually in Switzerland, where they were like sort of, they were from, and they were there for the pandemic. So, I mean, in a way, I feel like we were more global than like, it's just interesting. It's like, there's a level setting for sure. And I mean, it's a nice thing that, you know, we do a weekly team meeting with our whole team. And what we were doing for a while is that all the kids of like all the team members would bring, we would take turns and everyone would have their kids would perform or do something. We'd had like a little talent for a component where they would come in and they would sing or do a like magic show or just do something that just to like kind of, you know, the whole family gets involved now. There are definitely, everyone's having those moments where your kids are in your Zooms, right? So I think that's a silver lining. Like, yes, you do bring your whole self to work because your whole self is at home and at work with you all the time. Like, it's all happening at the same time. There's no separation anymore. So I think you could look at that as a silver lining. I like that you're doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, otherwise you would have a lot of embarrassing moments, because I've had some real, real amazing one-liners in the background of Zoom calls by my children.
Yeah.
that really leads to a bigger question, and I think a weighty one that has come up a lot, especially with the movement about gender and racial equality over the past, you know, 6 to 9 months specifically. It's been a bigger topic. So when we talk about the venture community, there's been a lot of conversations about women and minorities and the access to capital from founders of these groups that are starting companies. You're a female founder. You're also a member of a venture capital firm. And I'd love to spend a little bit of time talking about the stigma and the perception and the reality that you've seen working in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question. And I think one that we as a team, me personally, and I think both women founders and women investors certainly think about a lot. And where should I start? I mean,
I don't know. It's a big question, so I kept it broad. But I mean, well, maybe talk a little bit about, I mean, have you seen, since you've been with the firm over the course of the last, you know, is it three?
Four.
Four. I've
been at my firm for 4 years. Plus, I was there for a year as an associate when I was in grad school.
4 years. I've seen a change of the temperament and the amount of female founders that cross your desk.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you're right. Like, I've been a female founder. We fund a lot of female founders. Like, I have amazing women in my portfolio. I think it's kind of a unique moment. Like, I mean, certainly the track record for the industry, the numbers are not great. I mean, it's something like 2% or less than 3% of venture funding is going to women right now. Even less for people of color. So the track record is not great. And, I mean, I like to, I guess because of my own experience, I definitely have a lot of empathy for women founders and founders from underrepresented backgrounds, and try to, you know, give them as much advice and support and mentoring, even if we're not investing, like just telling them, like, look, anytime you need questions or you need support or you're trying to navigate this like really tricky world, like just reach out to me. Like I'll talk to you even if it's on my own time. I mean, change has been slow. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. There's definitely, I think the most hopeful things I'll say are just that there's definitely data that people tend to choose and invest and sort of trust and believe in people that are like themselves, right? Like we do it, we're very tribal as humans. And so I think that's, there's definitely data around that. And so I think, like, you know, part of the solution is, I think people know that increasing representation in venture firms is like part of the solution. Luckily, there's also data to show that like women-led funds with women who are decision makers and funds that are led by women, and actually also companies that are led by women, tend to have a better track record. So I think those things are hopeful because it means that like just without dispute, the numbers will lead us in the right direction. I mean, at the end of the day, venture capital investors are trying to get great returns, and you simply get those returns by investing in women and people of color. And so I think that there's obviously like a lot of room to grow. And I guess my own personal approach to it is just to try to like approach it with empathy and try to help wherever I can for you know, people that I come into contact with, and try to be champions for them whenever I can. So it's slow. I'm also part of a bunch of different industry groups and like mentoring programs for women founders. There's one group in particular called All Raise, which is trying to provide support to both women founders and VCs that I'm active with. And so I think like there are a lot of conversations happening around this right now, and there's more and more support all the time. So there's definitely like we're getting towards that tipping point. That probably sounds over optimistic. I do believe we're making progress, even if it's slow.
I believe that. I think there are some cultural and embedded beliefs, and I'm speaking only from the female perspective now, since I can't represent persons of color, but there's always a feeling that I've seen in mentoring young women in the advertising and marketing agency space, where women were always, in my experience, a little less apt to ask for the raise, the money, the promotion. And I have seen that in my female founders working on the marketing side, in coaching people to ask for the right amount of monetary value in exchange for the value that they bring to the table. And I find that culturally, I have to have more conversations with women about rising prices than I do with my male founders, which is interesting. Yeah. And all of my agency partners and consultants have said the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I don't think that it may be venture capital sometimes more opaque. Like it's really hard if you're on the outside to know how it works and what some of the rules are. And I think it was like, I'd been at my firm for maybe two and a half, three years before I started to feel like I had any sense. I knew it takes a while to get to understand like all, you know, how things work in any industry. It's not that dissimilar from tech as a whole. I mean, we primarily invest in tech startups, and I think like some of the challenges exist across the industry as a whole. I mean, there are definitely now at least a handful of like really there are a lot of really prominent women founders who've done amazingly well. And I do agree with you. I sometimes do find myself in the position of telling women founders to, I think, like pitch the $1 billion vision. Like, don't just pitch, a business. Pitch, make sure you're pitching your like best case scenario, not just like the one where you can hit the numbers, because investors are always going to be discounting. Like, they're going to be like, oh, well, that person's pitching this much, so if they hit half of that, do I still like it? And so, you know, remembering not to take yourself out of the running, because you, I think that women are more likely to feel conflicted about possibly promising something they can't, you know, not wanting to ever overpromise. But I think like investors get compelled by a big picture vision. And so that does happen, I think.
That's an important, I think, lesson for people to think about. But that leads me into another question that comes up all the time when I've helped companies write venture decks and get in front of investors. We're always talking about, what are the pitfalls? What are those mistakes that you as a VC have seen time and time again, and that you would like to create this PSA about that says, hey, founder, don't do this?
In your deck itself?
Sure. We can start with the deck. We can start with the meeting.
Or the pitch.
Whichever place you'd like to start.
Okay. Well, it's a great question. I mean, pitching yourself or pitching your team, it's definitely a life lesson, right? Like, it's a life skill that I think it's great. You know, if you can be great at it, like, it will help you in so many different areas of your life. There's a lot of content out there on just like what slides to have, what areas to cover. I think some of the things I would say are some do's first, that, you know, you're always going to be, depending on how early you are, like we focus on really early stage companies. So sometimes it's literally just a team and a deck. And in that case, obviously that deck has to be really stellar. sometimes they have some traction, but like usually a company is less than 2 years old by the time we invest. So they're early. And so I think it's, you know, you're either pitching based on your team or your traction. I'd say that's one thing. And like, if you're really early, you haven't really built anything yet, you haven't had any sales yet or any pre-sales, then you're really pitching based on your team. So just remember that that needs to be in there. It needs to be upfront. And as you get later, you're pitching on your traction. So I think
that's actually really interesting, because I think I was under the impression more so that you're pitching on the idea and the problem that you solve and the market opportunity in these. So that's a good,
you are.
No,
and I think that obviously, you know, the problem and the product and your solution to that product, those are obviously like, that's the heart of your pitch. They're necessary, but they're not sufficient. Like, I think what closes the deal.
Got it.
So, I mean, like, important. I could see three pitches, you know, over, like, usually we might, and, you know, if there's ever a space that's worth tackling, usually there's a bunch of different teams that are tackling it. I won't see three pitches in the same week for the same topic, but I might over like a year or 6 months. And like, you know, people are, say you take a problem that the people are going about solving, and the problem is like pretty knowable. And then like, you can have only so many like answers to the solution as well. But like, the team is what is really going to be the clincher, or the traction, because what that shows me is that these guys have figured out their go-to-market, they've figured out how to really execute on this really well. So it's either that they have like data that can show me that they can execute on this really well, or that I believe that this team, from what they've done before, that they are the right people to tackle this and they can execute better on this than anyone else. So those two, I think, are the pivotal ones. Even though the other ones are also obviously, like, I have to believe in those, but the ones that get you across the line Or I would say those two.
That's interesting, because that leads me to another question that comes up a lot. And it said, okay, so you have an incredible idea, but an inexperienced team.
Yeah.
That's like the Sarah Blakeleys of the world, right? Who didn't have any experience, yeah, but did it anyway. Are you at a disadvantage if you're coming to the table with an amazing idea and a disruptive go-to-market, potentially traction, but it's a group of people that maybe don't have the top-tier school pedigree or haven't started a company in the past, but are coming, yeah, at a problem in a different way?
Yeah. And I mean, Sarah Blakely herself, like, she didn't raise much money, I think, until she was like 7 or 8 years in, right? Like, so, right. So she's probably part of the answer to this. And I mean, yeah, in a way, yes, it is harder. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. If you're, we do fund founders, you know, with a great idea and a deck. But we do like to see that they've built something before, like that at least helps convince them. And I think like part of the reasoning behind that is that, I mean, everyone thinks that it's just about the idea, but it's really not. You know, there are a lot of people who've taken, look at Facebook, right? Like, how many social networks were there before that, right? Like, it's not about the idea. It's about how well you execute on the idea. And for that, that's why it comes back. That's why it goes back to team and what they've done before. I mean, investors are placing their money or someone else's money that they're responsible for behind an idea. And they, you know, knowing that, I believe that great execution, wins. And so, you're part of what I'm doing. I mean, everyone that pitches me comes in with a $1 billion idea that, you know, they are convinced they're building. And my job is to pressure test that, right? Like, are they thinking about this? Have they done this? Have they tried this? I would say for, you know, advice to those first time founders or people who are worried about their pedigree or people who, you know, have not already had a multi-million-dollar exit, which is most of us, that there are still things that they can do. So my colleague and one of my mentors at my fund, he often says that if I can't believe that you could turn $1 into $10, why would I believe that you can turn 1 million into 10 million? Which is a little bit of like what we're trying to find, right? As investors. So I think like really early teams, they can show off a lot by being scrappy, by trying to do a lot with a little in the early stages. I think there are ways that you can prove out that there's demand. You can prove that you're a good marketer. You can, you could launch a direct-to-consumer product on Kickstarter with just, you know, mock-ups and some marketing ingenuity, right? Like, you could actually raise a whole bunch of money. We have companies that we've backed that have raised millions of dollars by doing like a really smart, thoughtful, creative Kickstarter campaign. I love it when companies come to me with that. It shows to me that they really know. It's like they're taking their concept, they're storytelling, they're presenting it in this like very like limited format over like a short period of time. And they have like this great like audience served up to them on Kickstarter of people who are like early adopters for products. So I find that that's just such like a great, I encourage like tons of teams to go out there and try that like as a Kickstarter, because to me, it's a great proxy that they know how to run a great launch campaign. Even before they have anything.
An example of somebody that you think did a great job launching on Kickstarter. I think that's great fodder for people to look at if they're looking at starting a business.
I mean, the one that comes to mind the first in our portfolio is Form Labs. And so, but they're not necessarily a product that everyone is going to use. Everyone probably in your audience uses all the time, but, it's a 3D printer. And they launched, and I think they might've raised $2 or $3 million on Kickstarter when they first launched. There are some great examples, out there of, people who have, they're the first one that comes to mind. And I know there are a couple of others.
There's a beanbag chair that I have that I'm not remembering what it's called, but I did buy it on Kickstarter, and it had, I believe they started the weighted blanket first.
Yeah. I just talked to a team that was doing trying to do like a child specific like an Amazon Echo, but more especially targeted and suited towards being really kid friendly. I know that there were teams that I went to MIT with that launched like a watch for blind people on Kickstarter, or like clothing made out of space fabrics, like really high tech fabrics, so that you could literally run a marathon in the suit, which they did, I think, as part of the Kickstarter campaign. They ran a marathon in the suit.
That's amazing. I think I need the Amazon Echo device, because my children found out last year how to get Christmas lists off of the Amazon Echo.
Okay, that's hilarious.
What was in mom's shopping cart? And it was not good. It was not ending well for me.
We're just dreading the moment when our kids learn how to order stuff for themselves on Amazon, because they already come to us and they're like, "Mommy, I need a new Lego set." And they've like been very thoughtful about what they need. And the minute they realize they can just tell Alexa, it's over. We're done. We're dead.
So I really loved what you said about proving traction and showing sales, or proving the tested background of the team backing this billion-dollar idea, which I think is good for people too to hear, that you sit down and meet with hundreds of founders every year and they're not bringing you a $10 million opportunity. They're bringing you a $1 billion opportunity, which is huge. And it's a different level that you need to be competing at if you're going to walk into those meetings. So on the contrarian side, because I always believe some of the best lessons come from what you should not do. So yeah. Using that frame, what are some of those kind of epic fails or red flags that you've after the meeting or the Zoom call in 2020, the teams kind of looked at each other and said, "Oh no, not that."
That's a great question. red flags. So, I mean, we like to see that, like, as you said, like we're looking for the founders that are prepared to kind of go the distance to build that billion-dollar company. And we know from our experience that this is not a 2-year turnaround. It's not a 3-year, it's not a 5-year turnaround. We want to talk to people who know that that's a 10-year commitment, right? Like, and their mindset is around that. They're not looking to you're not going to flip it like your company. Like, it takes a long time to build something valuable. And then they're sort of like their mindset, the team's mindset. Yeah. That we like to see that. As far as red flags, I would say that, if we ask them a lot of questions and, everything we like, we're, you know, imagine I asked you like, "Karen, what are all the other marketing, podcasts out there?" And if we hear something that just is like completely dismissive of everyone else, like, "Oh, they don't matter." They completely dismissing the competition or dismissing anyone that's been successful. Like, I think that's sometimes a red flag to us. Like, I think that we want to see people who are thoughtful about the reality that if you're in any space that's valuable, there's going to be competition. And you can't just like say, "Oh, well, they're no good." Like, I think you have to, like, we don't like it. I think it's a red flag for us when people are just dismissive. They're just like, well, we're the best. We don't have to worry about that. And which may be true, but it would be more convincing to me if they said, like, well, we're better on these specific points, like not just dismissing them out of hand. I think the other thing is that, you know, the reality is that every business that you build and anything that's worthwhile building is hard. And we like to hear when founders kind of embrace that and they're being thoughtful about the challenges. So there are challenges for every single business. So either it's expensive or, you know, there's a lot of risk in getting something out to market, or, you know, they need to line up like this complex, like maybe it's B2B to C, or like there's always something about the business that's tough, or maybe it's low margin. But like when I ask a founder about the riskiest part of their business and they just, again, like they just dismiss it, that's a red flag to me. I like it when we ask them a question like that, they embrace that and they say, oh, well, here's what I've thought about so far. It's, I think, defensiveness rather than like being able to have that reality check. Is something. And I mean, it's part of also like, you can't solve a problem unless you're able to look at it squarely. Mm-hmm. And there are always going to be when you're running a company, there's always a problem. There's literally a problem every single day that you're trying to solve. Usually like 10.
Your biggest risk is truly your blind side, for sure.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's a good way to say it. And so people who are not able to acknowledge that, like, you know, even a question from an obnoxious investor who's just met them, like, is, you know, I mean, it could be, I could be completely wrong. And, but still, like, how do they respond to those questions? Like, do they believe they're right all the time? Are we going to be able to have a conversation if I have feedback? So, because we're partnering with our founders over time, right? And so I can never help someone solve anything if they believe they have all the answers, or they believe that no one can help them. So we definitely look for that.
How many meetings do you feel like you have had over the course of your 4-year tenure, and how many of those resulted in an investment? Let's just give people the real deal on how hard it is to get to the deal making stage.
Well, it's a good question. And I do think that as a founder, I didn't have a sense of these numbers. But so we have a team of 5, and we probably look at maybe 1,000 companies a year. So we're meeting with about 100 companies a month across all 5 of us. And we invest in 1 or 2 out of 100. And then that probably, you can extrapolate that to the year as well. So, I mean, that is the hardest part of my job. So many of the people that I'm meeting with are amazing entrepreneurs. They have a fantastic idea. Many of them, I actually believe too, that they're going to build something valuable. But we don't have the bandwidth or resources to invest in all of them. And so we sort of hone in on the ones that we feel like we can add the most value to, that, like, obviously they don't conflict with anything that's already in our portfolio, and like just the ones that we end up getting the most conviction around. But there's definitely like a big chunk of companies that I meet with and founders that where I want to help them. I want to support them. I oftentimes try to stay in touch with them, but that we can't work with everybody. So it's, the numbers are tough. So if you're a founder, you're trying to be the top, you know, 3% maybe, to get funded.
Yeah, that is a tricky stat. So the companies that come and get invested in and stay in your portfolio, what separates the good from the great? What is something that you've identified in a lot of your unicorns, or whatever word you want to use, that is ubiquitous across those who really succeed?
That's yeah, it's a great question. I think that they're kind of related to something I said before. Like, they're always looking for feedback. They're always trying to improve. They're always trying to get better at what they do. They're sort of like they're always vigilant about that, about constantly trying to just keep executing better. I think that's what separates the good from the great. It's like, you know, with like the best athletes, I'm reading this book by Michael Phelps, coach right now. And, you know, like they're just always looking for ways to improve their competitive edge. Like that's what they stay up at night doing.
Yeah.
And, that's, you know, it's rare. And those are usually, I mean, and not in a way that's unhealthy. Like I'm not encouraging people to just be anxious and never stop working. Like, all I mean is that I see the best founders constantly iterating on what they're doing, always trying to like do it better, and knowing also like what do they need to execute on at any given point, like not trying to boil the ocean. The best founders say no to a lot.
That is a brilliant statement, because I think the most successful humans, and I think especially in COVID, this has come up for me a lot. It is making sure that you're putting some white space in your day. I mean, I find that my best, most disruptive ideas come when I am doing something unrelated to work.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. I think especially for, I mean, all of us are. I remember seeing this picture on Twitter like a couple of weeks ago, and it was this woman who's like a public health scientist, and she was being interviewed. Did you see this? She was being interviewed by like CNN, or like she was on the news. And so she had her interview set up like just like this. Like, she was sitting in front of her laptop talking, and then she had like, you know, her caption was kind of like, the image, and it's like her talking head, like important, brilliant woman on a, you know, on a newscast. And then it was like the rest of the picture, like what you couldn't see from the picture was that like she was in a room surrounded by kids' toys. Like, you know, her books were, there was like a stack, her laptop was like stacked really high on this like tall book of toys so she could stand. So you couldn't see like the disaster that the room was, because it was also clearly a work from home room. And like, I just think people are juggling a lot, and like, yes, like it's absolutely, you know, it's so tough for people right now. And, but yeah, I mean, if you can find that white space, like it is, well, it's a sanity saver, but it also helps you do your best work.
It does. So in our last two questions, I like to do a little bit of a speed round and just see what comes to mind when I ask the question. The most successful companies I've invested in have fill in the blank.
They have combined like a really amazing product with a really, really thoughtful go-to-market.
Beautiful. And the one thing I want every founder to know is...
Well, I'm going to steal from the theme of your podcast, and I would say that manage their momentum.
Beautiful. So what's next for you? You have been with Founder for 4 years, and what is your vision for the next phase in your life?
I mean, I still consider myself a student of investing. I've been investing for 4 years, as you said, and just, you know, trying to find the next billion-dollar company that's out there. I really think what I'm motivated by day to day is I love building. I love like brainstorming with my founders on a marketing campaign or product roadmap, or like why I love what I do is I get to work with a broad range of founders on helping them build and accelerate. I'm just, you know, I want to kind of keep taking that to the next level. And who knows exactly how.
That's beautiful. So if somebody is listening and they said, I have your next billion-dollar idea with a billion-dollar team and a beautiful go-to-market strategy, what can they do next? Can they follow up with you directly?
They can email me. So we have a mailbox set up for a fund. They can, and I see almost everything that goes into that. So they can email me at contact@foundercollective.com, or they could follow me on Twitter, where I am Parulia, P-A-R-U-L-I-A, and my DMs are open on there too. So you can send me a note on there.
And so just the process question for somebody that heard that and got really excited that you gave an email address. Do they send you an email or do they send you an actual deck?
Well, it's always helpful when someone sends us at least a deck. And I would say for founders who are worried about that, that like you can send a preview deck. It doesn't have to have your financials in it. It doesn't really have, but like at least something that gives us a sense of your team and the opportunity that you're trying to tackle, so that we can at least, you know, say like, oh, we really love the space, or we really love what direction you're going in, or, oh, there's another company we have in our portfolio that's doing this exact same thing. So that wouldn't work. Like just enough to kind of give us a little taste of what you're doing. And it's really helpful if you can send a deck.
That is a great piece of advice to leave this on. So I think the takeaway from working with the VC community is to understand that there is a lot of ways to bring a big market idea to market. And one of the ways is working with a VC. And there are other, you know, manners of going to market and building that traction. And that things like Kickstarter or more bootstrapped ideas to prove your value and prove your team can be met with open arms from the investment community. So there isn't one way to do this, but it is important in the value of the team that you have behind the idea and the traction that you've had to date.
For sure. Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I think there's a lot of paths up the mountain, and you know, it's an amazing, amazing process to build a company. And you know, everyone has to kind of find their own way with that.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I think this is a really helpful topic in a space that I feel like a lot of founders feel is masked with secrecy and a lot of, you know, people behind a curtain. So I really appreciate you being so open and talking about your experiences in these meetings. And I, you know, really would say, look at the show notes and we will be able to provide the email address. You will send your deck if you want to get in front of Founder Collective, and follow Parul on Twitter. To get more tips for Marketing Magnet, every Friday we are here talking about ways to add momentum to your life and business. Go follow us on iTunes and get our weekly releases. Go to momentummagnet.com where you can see all of our past shows, and shoot us a note. Like us and follow. It helps us understand what shows resonate best and make sure we get the best upcoming guests possible. We thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful Friday.
Thank you for listening to Momentum Magnet. We're here every Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time to share inspiring comeback stories. We want to hear your reviews and love getting your subscriptions on iTunes and Spotify. For show notes and past episodes, visit momentummagnet.com. I'm Karen Morales, keynote speaker, writer, and founder and CEO of Marketing Magnet, a fast-growing marketing agency for purpose-driven companies. Whether you are a business needing an agency, or if you are looking for weekly tips to get ahead, sign up at marketing-magnet.com to receive our weekly inspiration on getting more in your life and business.